Let's see if after an introduction like that I can figure out how to get my slides to go. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to work with Charles and the PAHO colleagues, and I'm as interested as I hope you are in hearing the presentation about the work that's been done in the Americas. I'm really here to set some groundwork so that you understand more clearly work that has happened over the past decade on the issue of workforce competencies. So again, thank you very much for this opportunity, and I've had a chance to talk to a few of you, and I thank you for coming because this is good to have a sense of what this kind of work takes, how it's spreading around the globe, if you will, and how in the process of defining the, if you will, competencies, that you develop partnerships and friendships that have a great capacity to change public health and, if you will, hopefully health outcomes. So again, this is one of the many contributors, I think, to the kind of collaboration and cooperation that are required to really change health outcomes around the globe. Defining what it is that people need to know and do and having them work together on determining that, studying that, is really one of the first steps. So I applaud the work of PAHO in that regard. You always have to disclose I have absolutely no financial relationships or commercial interests in this. This is, as I would say, a labor of love to work here. Some of the things I'm going to try to cover today, and I'll do that fairly fast, is compare and contrast some of the approaches to the development of competency frameworks for public health practice in North America. I am not the spokesperson for everything that happened in the U.S., nor the spokesperson for everything that happened in Canada, but I have worked on both of the projects, and I can give you the top notes and refer you to other sources. I'll quickly do some description of the benefits of implementing these standards in public health practice in academic settings, and then hope that we can recognize the importance of influencing the adoption of these standards through policy, national accreditation, certification systems, how professional associations and membership groups really drive the change. Quite honestly, a competency framework that gets developed and sits in a binder or a report from a meeting, I wouldn't say is useless. It's useful to those who participated, of course, but there has to be a strategy for implementation. And I don't, whether it's PAHO or the Council of Linkages here in U.S. or the Public Health Agency of Canada or any other place, this requires an ongoing commitment to review and evaluation of the utility of these types of documents. Again, just a quick refresher, we might argue all day about definitions. Competency is the knowledge, skills, and abilities or attitudes KSAs needed to perform a specific task or function. Often when we use the word competency, very broadly read, it's really the collection of skills that someone needs to perform in a certain skill. Competency framework usually outlines and defines those KSAs that are needed for a profession. Often that's what you build your professional exams upon, and it also assists academic programs in defining their curriculum and how they're approaching education. The term core competencies for public health, as it has been used here in U.S. and Canada, are the essential knowledge, skills, and attitudes necessary for the practice of public health. They transcend the boundaries of a specific discipline and are independent of a program or topic. So that's how that term has been used, certainly in North America. It's not that, you know, in other words, there are many disciplines that address the issues of public health. So the effort, certainly the effort in the U.S., was to see what was out there and then to develop a cross-cutting or set of core competencies that could be agreed upon, which basically state what is it that public health professionals do. So those are the definitions. This appears on the front end to be a fairly complex slide, and while I don't give reference at the bottom, it's work that I participated in personally. We wound up calling it the mock model, and that was just because a bunch of us sat around with a paper napkin, and it was Kathleen Miner, Melissa Alpern, C for mock is Chaffee, and H was for a colleague and friend, Nancy Hall. And what we did is we were trying to explain how these various system pieces might be put together. Let's start at the top where the arrow is. When you think about what you want organizations to be able to do, that leads you to a sense of, well, what is the mix of the workforce in contributing to the ability of the organization to perform? I might even kick that up a notch and maybe use the new term, which is capabilities. What are the capabilities that an organization has to perform? And then a subset of that, if you will, would be what does the workforce do to enable you to have those capabilities? And that's where you get that mix, that melange of the various professional groups, or in some cases non-professional groups, who are really part of making the organization work. If you go down from that, you know, and this is often where we get confused, it's what it you make a pretty big leap from all of the things that people do in an organization to how do you design the training and the experiences that enable them to do that. And I think you come down to that left-hand corner, and that's the part that anybody who's done training and development is very, very familiar with, whether you're a faculty member or whether you're a training person. It's like, how do you build the right kind of learning experiences so people know what they need to do? Nurse education, pharmacy education, medical education. And what you do is you describe, what is the instruction intended to do? We could have called that box learning outcomes or something, but essentially you assess the need, you plan, develop, deliver, and evaluate the training. But even if you do all of that, as a result of that, if you move over more towards that next arrow, you're going to be assessing individual performance. It still has nothing to do, if you will, about the organizational performance. But you certainly need to do that corner well. And we could go to lots of other professional meetings and people, in fact, I know they're all lined up, they're talking about evaluating and implementing. So what does the competency framework do? When professionals come together and define a competency framework, it enables that lower right-hand quadrant to be done in a more consistent and thoughtful way. It means many people have looked at and agreed upon what it is that people need to know and do, and therefore when you develop your training, whether these are courses in schools of public health, nursing, or just training within a local health department, you're saying, is what you're doing mapped to improving the proficiency of your workforce to perform? So it gives a framework, it tells people the what is important. You can always add to it, you can always drill down more, but this is the broad framework around which you should be preparing your workforce to know, understand the what it is to be in, and in this case we're talking about public health. One of the other things, if you'll notice, there's that little dotted line from individual performance over to the topic of credentialing with a definition that says credentialing of the workforce by any professional organization or other aspect is really just one mechanism of enhancing consistency in professional practice and establishing individual performance standards. How many folks do we have in here who might be nurses? Okay. How many, any pharmacists in here? Any physicians in here? Okay. Any people who have been credentialed or certified in another area? I'm not talking, okay, we can count CPR. Also, human resources, whatever. Really all that is it's a notch up, and it says individuals who have been credentialed have been put through some sort of objective, standardized process whereby they have the skill set that we consider important for some level of professional performance. So while credentialing is helpful, it is, again, still defining individual performance. When you kick it up a notch and you're looking at organizational performance, then you move to accreditation. How many of you are, well, I'm going to go back to the credentialing box. How many of you have heard about, familiar with the credentialing, or if you will, board certification for public health professionals, the national board? Okay. Anyone here is a CHESS member in U.S.? Okay. So you understand that process. Health educators got together, define what it means to be an entry in a more advanced level health educator. They have a process, and when you get that CHESS, you feel really good about it. And then they even tell you which courses you need to take in order to maintain that credential, similar with the national board. So these are mechanisms, and anyone who's in an area like pharmacy, nursing, dentistry is very familiar with the continuing education process. Okay, kick it up a notch. We're talking about organizations that are able to do what we expect them to do, and you'll see the dotted line going over from there, which talks about accreditation. How many, I mean, anyone here who's in the U.S. is familiar probably with the Joint Commission accreditation process. I see a nod. Accreditation, how many are familiar with the FAB, Public Health Accreditation Board? Okay, and actually to bring, that was like 15 years in process as far as I can figure out. But it's a voluntary accreditation for local public health, state public health, and local boards of health. But, you know, and the Joint Commission certainly has been successful. Why do you think it's successful in the U.S.? What's tied to having a Joint Commission accreditation? Right, you won't get your money if you're not accredited. And so what I'm hoping you're beginning to see here is when you start attaching an accreditation process to another incentive, you can begin to influence and drive all these other boxes. Credentialing, if you notice, is, while it is important, what do you think drives people to seek credentialing? Give me some ideas on that. Anyone who's credentialed can speak up, or non-credentialed. Why do you think people go after credentials? What might be associated with it?
Increased pay.
Might be an increased pay. What else might it be?
Promotion.
It could be tied to a promotion. It could be just because, you know, it's like a personal motivator. You are, like, so attached to your discipline that you really want to grow professionally. There may be other motivators as well. But I think what you're seeing, and the reason I'm trying to lay this down here, is unless you think about competencies in the context of what they can do or not do, and don't think about these other system pieces, then you won't have the levers, the influencers, the drivers that keep people embracing them and applying them. Again, back to the implementation is everything. And I would say I just came from an ASPH meeting just yesterday. You know, if people are almost like, one more competency framework, where do I stick it? I mean, what do I do with it? And the reality is, it's nice to have, but if you don't figure out an implementation process, if you don't periodically review it and look at it again, at the end of days, you'll have a lot of these things and no one will know what to do with them. And, you know, I don't need competency frameworks to tell me whether I'm competent or incompetent, or what was my line on that? Unconsciously incompetent. Okay. All right. Charles referred to the essential services. This is a picture of what was agreed upon in the U.S. probably 15, maybe 20 years ago. Hasn't really changed considerably. Always a debate about whether it really captured everything that people need to know and do. This sort of framework not only formed the foundation of the work that Charles remembers back in the Americas, you know, to determine the functions, but it's also the basis for what's going on with the accreditation that's currently underway here in the U.S. Just to quickly review, we alluded to it before, the Council on Linkages between Academia and Practice, which is in fact just that. It's got representation from major professional associations and has been coordinated by the Public Health Foundation. Met and in response a long time ago to one of the IOM reports, started the process of developing competencies for public health practice, published a document in 2001, went through an extensive vetting period and got feedback. I am not here to tell you the process. You could go to that website, find out everything you needed to know about how they did it, but it has been a very thorough process with a lot of input from, and in fact, the first step they did was they went out to all the existing professions, gathered up what people had discussed as frameworks for competency, and literally created a here's a crosswalk. Here's what everyone's saying, and here's how we go from here. They've revisited it very recently. They've wanted to fine-tune it. Clearly, some of the big advances of the past 10 years have been in the area of informatics. There are things that weren't in the original framework, which now one would argue need to be included. In that interim, in 2006, the Association of Schools of Public Health had a process, again, a participatory process, where they came to agree upon what they thought were the core competencies for the MPH program. Again, taking the five core areas, adding a few more, and then wrote that up. And that with the idea was, and what was the driver for that? Part of the driver for that was if they were going to have a national board, they were going to have to come up with something that really could be the just that could really be the basis for that. Will this be changed? Probably, because you can't stop the change in society and in the practice of public health. In fact, went to a meeting yesterday, they're going to go back and start revisiting some of these things. But in the interim, they not only did that core competency framework, they've actually started thinking about undergraduate education, global health. So they want to kind of nail down what do we think are the general skill sets that need to be developed by, again, academia. Other groups have taken it and run with it. The nurses always do. I'm involved in some projects that try to define preparedness and emergency response. It's why has that been useful for me? Well, we fund programs to develop the training. And if we don't state what's important, then we won't get what we think is required. So they do serve, they do have value. That got fuzzy because I had to take it off the web and I couldn't get any clearer. That's a document, Core Competencies for Public Health in Canada. And as Charles alluded to, there was a great deal, I mean, there wasn't a Public Health Agency of Canada per se, Charles, am I correct, until after the SARS challenge. They needed to think about how are we organized for public health in Canada. Anyway, as part of that, they were looking around and they thought about, well, how do we define public health practice in Canada? I mean, they're very much their provinces. You know, very independent. There are things that are done at a federal level, but there are a lot of things that are very local. But they did come together. With Charles, we were part of an initial consultation. They looked at what was done in the U.S. They looked at what was done in England, or U.K., I should say. And then they did their own thing, which is really what everyone has to do. You're not going to adopt 100% what happened elsewhere because you'll miss the very basic step, which is this is consensus building. Nobody wants to take what somebody else developed and go, oh, yeah, it looks good to me, we're going to, because there's no buy-in. So that being done, they did regional meetings, they did a Pan-Canadian survey, they had a lot of implementation pilots, again, getting back on the importance of test it, don't just adopt it, have a plan for how it works or doesn't work, listen to the voices that don't agree with it, you have to listen to the people on the fringes. And then work with your disciplines and your professional organizations, because if you noted on the earlier chart, if you don't have them on the team driving the adoption of this or saying, I like that, I'm going to connect to your framework and describe what people in my discipline need to do that's above and beyond that. So again, and I think these are all going to be part of the sign-up, but if anybody needs these slides, I am happy to send them to you personally if you give me your card. All right. Quickly, a crosswalk between the two. There was a lot of similarity in the domains, 7 for Canada, 8 for U.S. They articulated 36 core competencies. In U.S., there were 6 or 13 per domain, and it varied by target audience and level, and I'll get to that in a moment. The target audiences at Canada were described as frontline provider, consultant and specialist, manager and supervisor. In U.S., because the focus was specifically on governmental public health, the target audiences were defined as entry level, i.e. entry into defined public health practice, supervisor, and then the management CEO. I did a crosswalk of the domains. You'll see that they are very, very similar. Line them up. I think some key issues is, well, they just use the term leadership. There was a big thought on having leadership systems thinking, also the desire in the U.S. side to speak about financial planning and management, also a bigger articulation of the implementation and evaluation component. Again, what were the stimulus for action? For Canada, it was the Building the Public Health Workforce for the 21st Century, which was their document from 2006. In U.S., it was the 1988, 2002, and 2003 Institute of Medicine reports, where there was a really strong message recommendation around using competencies and core competencies, and then also collaborating across disciplines. Results to date, just as FYI, and I'll present that in just a moment, 50% of the state and local health departments and 90% of academic institutions use the core competencies here in U.S. Both of those, the state and local report is coming out of profiles that are done by NACHO and ASTO here in U.S. The 90% of academic institutions used is a more restrictive. The Public Health Foundation has done some studies that polled schools of nursing, schools of public health. One of the things I do in my spare time is accredit public health programs, and I can tell you people are fluent in the competency frameworks when you get there because it's one of the standards they have to speak to. How do we, and I may skip this, I think this group is knowledgeable about the benefits of doing this work. I'm going to jump to the bottom. It really supports collaborative interdisciplinary practice, and quite honestly, that's the future. Bottom line, encourages the alignment of discipline-specific and program-specific competencies. So those are two, and I think the rest you can read. What influences the adoption? I think from the get-go, you have to have a plan for disseminating and communicating. I can't say that was always the case in U.S., Canada. Sometimes you have to, you know, run back and go, okay, now it's time. Certainly resource materials and toolkits that actually help people on the ground figure out how to use this. Very practical, hands-on, here's how you take the framework and here's how you translate it. Very useful, wonderful creativity that occurs. I think moving into accreditation certification systems that value and honor the competency frameworks, without advocacy of your professional associations or membership groups, it doesn't go. And quite honestly, I would say there has to be some process to monitor, report how it's used and benefits. In U.S., we've been able to encourage our practice partners like the ASTOs and NACHOs of the world. Now the FAB will be one mechanism. We've been able to build in some of this into there's in Healthy People 2010 and 2020. We've advocated for a chapter that has public health infrastructure in it to include addressing the adoption of core competency frameworks. So those are, if you go back to that systems piece I presented, you know, we've tried to think about ways of moving this forward in and measuring the effect because, unlike Canada, we don't have a more centralized approach. So we've had to take that. In Canada, they've built all their continuing education around their competency framework, and they continue to work with their regions on the issue. They've also, for the Public Health Agency of Canada itself, they've really used competency frameworks for all their job descriptions. So they're building in some incentives in a slightly different way. I hope I'm not over my thing. I'm on? Okay. Great. This is it. That was the last slide. Here are some people. Go to the Public Health Foundation table, APHA. They'll tell you everything you want to know about both the Council of Leakages and the Competency Framework. Same thing with the Association of Schools of Public Health table. Personal compliments to Rachel Roberts and Jennifer Lowe from the Public Health Agency of Canada. And, of course, always thanks to the colleagues. And there is actually a reference list that came along with it. So, okay, thank you.